Welcome to Making Contact, an international radio program seeking to create connections between people, vital ideas, and important information. This week on Making Contact.
During the confrontation, he got in an argument with Sean Joyce, the off-duty deputy sheriff, and the deputy sheriff shot him six times, twice in the back, according to the police reports.
Let us make no mistake. Police brutality is the manifestations of policies put in place by the forces of avarice and greed.
Several high-profile cases in recent years have exposed what some activists are terming an epidemic of police brutality. On this program, you'll hear from parents and others who are fighting back against a pattern of violence and misconduct at law enforcement agencies across the United States. I'm Philip Babich, your host this week on Making Contact. In the aftermath of the Rodney King verdict, an acquittal of the four Los Angeles police officers who brutalized King during a traffic stop, and subsequent civil unrest in 1992, police departments nationwide pledged to keep themselves in check and avoid instances of excessive force. 6 years later, police-related violence and deaths are almost routine. The torture of Haitian immigrant Abner Louima at the hands of four New York City police officers who sodomized him with a toilet plunger in a precinct bathroom is but one example of recent abuses. To raise awareness about these issues, activists gathered in New York last year for a march and rally.
We say no! We will not forget! We will keep these horrors in front of us to remind us that it was Mr. Louima in August. It could be your son, your husband, your brother, your daughter, your father next time. It could be you next time. It could be me next time. There's no telling. And why not? Prisons are the largest growing industry in the country today. Who are they being built for? They say that crime has dropped. So who is to occupy these prisons? Not the rich, not the privileged, not the CEOs and the bankers who steal wealth at untold amounts and methods and who destroy lives and countries for a better return on their dividends. No, it's for the brother or sister who at their wits' end drinks a beer on the street or hawks a turnstile for lack of a token. The death houses of the prisons are busy producing the highest body count in decades. But that's only the tip of the iceberg. The oppression and exploitation of workers cannot take place without an occupying armed force in the communities. And it is not just in our communities. Let us make no mistake. Police brutality is the manifestations of policies put in place by the forces of avarice and greed. We must pledge to continue to struggle against the chains which threaten to shackle us again into the servitude of an unenlightened thinking. We must continue to say no to police brutality. No more beatings, no more chokings, no more shootings. And then we must look beyond our own shores and know that the policies that are killing us are killing our sisters and brothers around the world. And we must say no to that too.
The same thing is happening up in Albany, the capital of New York, and it's being tolerated. I have two young sons, one is 19, one is 16, who was brutally beaten by Albany Police Department, 2nd Division, on the night of the Black and Hispanic Caucus. They ambushed those boys, three of them, one of them was their friends. ambush them and beat them. My son first saw a police officer when he came in contact with a baton in his stomach. Turn around, you nappy-headed, funny-looking thing. My son had a hat on, covered all his hair. Okay, obviously, that was an intentional racism. But the other one had a dog, was taunting at my son. My son said to him, get the dog off me or I'll sue you. And by the time he could say that, another police officer came and pushed him. He airborne, hit the ground, and his body rocked back and forth. And five of them jumped on him, handcuffed him, and beat him while the dog was eating away at his clothes. The dog ate out all his chest of his clothes, all the collar of him. He had the skin tore from his neck, the 16-year-old, by a police officer from a chokehold. The other one had a big lump on the side of his head, one over his eye. He's a track star. He ran in the Empire State game the same night that happened. His shin is busted. His knees is busted. He's not able to run. He was at a track scholarship at Morehouse College. He's not able to run anymore. He's depressed. He's breaking out in hives. He's not handling, he's not able to study anymore. He went there to study robotics engineering, a co-op program with Georgia Tech and Morehouse. He's unable to go to perform now because of the situation that happened to them. They were thrown in jail for 6 days without any medical attention. The jaw was dislocated. He couldn't eat for 6 days. No medical attention. They were treated like animals in their precinct. We have a mayor in the city of Albany called Mayor Jennings. He lied to us over and over that he was investigating and he's going to make a statement in 2 weeks. It's now October 22nd. This happened August 3rd, the night of the Black and Hispanic Caucus. And nothing was ever done to my sons. They jumped up 13 felonies, 10 misdemeanor on my sons, which I fought until they dropped every last one of them, equivalent to a parking violation. You understand? Certainly did not warrant 6 days in jail and an ass whooping. My boys were brutally beaten, and I'm not gonna let it go. And I'm here to tell Mayor Jennings and Giuliani, if you can't control your beasts and your boys, you cannot control any city at all.
This wave of police violence is not just limited to urban areas. In rural Nevada County, California, a man was gunned down by an off-duty police officer during an argument. Correspondent Mike Thornton spoke with the parents of the victim, Michael Minnick, who was an ex-convict. Don Minnick begins by describing the circumstances of the shooting. He's followed by his wife, Sue.
Our son had just gotten back from spending the afternoon and early evening with his wife and three other boys at the South Fork of the Yuba River down by Bridgeport. And when he got back, there was some target shooting. He heard some guns being fired towards the place where he was living with his wife. And he had gone up there to confront the person about shooting. And apparently, during the confrontation, he got in an argument with Sean Joyce, the off-duty deputy sheriff, and the deputy sheriff shot him 6 times. Twice in the back, according to the police reports. We found out about it when we were at home that night. We couldn't sleep. We was watching the news on television early in the morning, and that it was over the television that we discovered this. They didn't tell us at the scene. They wouldn't tell us anything. And we found out that it was an actual killing, in my view, it was a killing and not an accident. We found out through television. And we flat accused them of trying to cover this up because of the way the questions that were being asked, the things that were happening, the way they were treating us, and they were treating Mike as a perpetrator. First off, they wouldn't let us see Mike, and then they released him to whoever does the autopsies, and after they were through, when we talked to the person at the mortuary, he said we wouldn't want to see Mike then because the autopsy, they cut him up so bad. that we wanted to remember him as he was the last time we saw him. And I had seen him just the night before at the county fairgrounds.
I just think it very odd that they wouldn't even arrest this man, whether he be a sheriff, a minister, or just a person off the street.
Yeah, one's a policeman, one's an ex-con. Problem solved.
Sean Joyce said he feared for his life. He had a hidden gun, 380, semi-automatic. His wife went for her gun. The three boys that I know of, they only had two 22s, but still, add up all these and figure it out.
And also, he kicked Mike.
He was the one that started
the confrontation.
As far as the investigation goes, they ought to fire those guys. Not in just our son's case, but lots and lots of other cases. They don't do a thorough investigation.
Or they don't do anything.
But I keep thinking to myself, and my grandchildren also have said, the littlest one had said, she was 9 at the time, Grandma, how come they never arrested the man that killed Uncle Mike? And I tell her, because one day he will have to face God.
It starts at the top with the leader. My wife and I, we went in last February, over a year ago. It happened to be on our anniversary that we finally got, about 6 months after Mike was killed, we finally got to talk to Sheriff Arbaugh. The first thing we asked Sheriff Arbaugh was if he had read the report, and he said, no, I haven't read it. I glanced at it, and I said, well, after all the furor that's been, you haven't read that. And he said, no. And I said, well, you should read it, and read it from a perspective as a layperson, not as a sheriff. He said he would do that. He answered a lot of my questions, but there was a half a dozen that he couldn't answer because he didn't know the answers. He said he would find out. He says, I'll get back to you within a week or so. It's been a year and a month. We haven't heard from that man. And he's had plenty of chances to talk to us. He has not gotten back to us to answer those questions.
Well, what would you like to see happen out of this?
Well, first of all, I don't want this happening to anyone else. I want good, honest, and I mean very, very honest leadership in this county. It is just that it's getting to a point where thousands of people can't trust the law enforcement here. A certain amount of, not all of them. And I would like to see much better leadership.
We were like a lot of people, I assume, that had their heads buried in the sand. And I just thought, things are going to go along real fine. There's no problem until it happens to you. And when you become involved in this system, if everybody is, and there's a lot of them out there that have been treated just like we have. They've been ignored. They don't get the questions answered. They get pushed aside. They've been treated like second-class citizens. That has to change.
Don and Sue Minnick, parents of Michael Minnick, who was shot to death by an off-duty police officer. Correspondent Mike Thornton also spoke with the district attorney who was in charge of investigating the case. Thornton asked DA Mike Ferguson why he chose not to press charges against Officer Sean Joyce, who was not in his jurisdiction at the time of the shooting.
There are times when there are officer-involved shootings in other counties where that same call is made. They know where they're going to find the officer. He's not going to go anywhere. I think that in defending their action at one point in time, I believe it was Assistant Sheriff Troner indicated that they knew that Mr. Joyce would be found and is not going to go anywhere and is not likely to flee.
Mike, I'm sorry, but this is a question that I have to ask you. And you just referred to this as an officer-involved shooting, but Sheriff Joyce was not in his capacity as a police officer.
No, but he was an off-duty police officer.
But
I can't read the mind of the officer out there who made the call whether to arrest or not.
And
I'm not suggesting
that you can, okay? But what I am saying is that, I mean, isn't that statement in and of itself somewhat telling that the shooting, just in sort of an amorphous mindset, that this was an officer-involved shooting, which somehow makes it different than a civilian shooting. And I think that that's what the crux of the concern of the community is.
It should be.
Is that this was viewed as an officer-involved shooting. I mean,
off-duty officer from another jurisdiction, therefore, they didn't treat him the way they should have treated him?
But isn't that almost what you just said? That it was an officer-involved shooting, and because it was an officer-involved shooting, that's why he wasn't arrested?
But it wasn't an officer-involved shooting from the standpoint of somebody being on duty.
Well, I understand.
I was trying to draw an analogy to an actual officer-involved shooting that would occur in, you know, like a big county like L.A. or Sacramento by saying they don't arrest the officer every time they have an officer-involved shooting.
But that's it. That's when that police officer shoots someone in the capacity of his duty as a police officer.
That's correct.
Not as a private citizen in his father's backyard.
That's correct. I understand what you're saying, but I'm trying, in some respects, to play devil's advocate here.
Okay.
District Attorney Mike Ferguson speaking with correspondent Mike Thornton. You are listening to Making Contact, a production of the National Radio Project. If you want more information about the subject of this week's program, please give us a call. It's toll-free, 800-529-5736. Call that same phone number for tapes and transcripts, or if you want to make a comment or suggestion for future programs, that's 800-529-5736. Young people, especially young people of color, are often at risk of police harassment, and in some cases, violence. That risk is sometimes exacerbated when a youth is affiliated with a gang or a group of individuals who could be mistaken for a gang. That's one of the reasons why two rival gangs in Southern California, the Crips and Bloods, signed an historic truce in 1992. Correspondent Christian Parenti spoke with Dwayne Holmes, a former gang leader who was instrumental in forging the peace agreement. According to many witnesses, Holmes was framed for a $10 robbery because of his involvement with the truce. Despite the intervention of Congresswoman Maxine Waters, then presidential candidate Jerry Brown, state senator Tom Hayden, and author Mike Davis, Holmes was sentenced to 7 years in prison. He was released after 3.5 years. Holmes told Parenti that the police framed him because a ceasefire between the notorious street gangs meant the groups were more organized to challenge police brutality, which was running rampant in the Watts housing projects.
There were incidents that was taking place in at least three of the four housing projects that's located in this this kind of like small geographical area in the Watts community. In the Imperial Courts housing projects in which I lived, my cousin, Henry Pico, had been murdered by the Los Angeles Police Department. In the Jordan Down housing projects, there was an incident where the residents had got into a physical brawl with law enforcement behind some unlawful treatment of the residents inside of the housing projects. In the Nickerson Garden, there were a confrontation that I think resulted in some type of gun battle between law enforcement and the residents over there as a result of some other type of unlawful acts that was being perpetrated by the Los Angeles Police Department against the residents in the housing projects. In an attempt to try to consolidate the different groups that had sprung up in these different housing projects during that time to address those issues. In my housing projects, we had the Henry Pico Justice Committee that had been formed to bring some attention to police abuse and police misconduct. In the Nickerson Gardens, they had developed a community, like, you know, a group of concerned citizens. And in the Jordan Downs, there was an attempt by some individuals through AmeriCan and other groups to also foster some type of sense of dialogue around the issue of police misconduct and police abuse. in the wake of that, and understanding that in order for these groups of concerned citizens to get together and to begin to figure out a strategy to address this whole issue, there needed to be a clearance. There needed to be some type of agreement amongst the aggressive elements in these different communities, which is identified as gangs, for a better word. There needed to be some type of agreement with them established, so that individuals like myself, who was a member of the Imperial Courts Gang, the PJ Watts Crips, and individuals like Daoud Sherrells, who was a member of the Grape Street Watts Baby Lokes, and individuals like BJ and Hank Nim, who were from the Nickerson Garden Bounty Hunters, there needed to be an agreement with these gangs that these individuals represented, in order for these individuals to come over into this neighborhood and to begin to participate in the discussion about how to go about addressing this urgent need to deal with law enforcement, or to actually address the issue of police abuse.
So now people are fairly familiar with what happened once there was a truce. It was signed and solidified right before the riots. But then what happened to you? Could you just briefly tell us about the trouble with the police?
Well, my trouble with the police begun before the inception of the truce and everything. I think that the signing of this Declaration of Peace, and me being an individual who had an extensive record, criminal record, and gang activity, etc., spearheading this whole movement in terms of trying to consolidate these different aggressive elements in the community, placed me at the forefront of the police's agenda in terms of whom was a threat, and whom we needed to isolate in order to dismantle this whole movement, because that's eventually what the ceasefire agreement was turning into. Law enforcement, however, viewed that as a threat, and understandably so. We were talking about declaring a ceasefire amongst ourselves. You know, no one talked about getting at the police, but no one talked about making a pact or a truce, forming a truce with law enforcement. I think that law enforcement saw that as, we were coming together and we were talking about setting aside our differences, but the fact that we wasn't talking about setting aside our differences with law enforcement made them the primary target or focus of our anger and our rage. And I think that scared them more than anything else.
You ended up being framed, and you had numerous celebrities and politicians at your sentencing hearing, but to no avail, because you ended up going to prison. So when you got out, what was the situation on the street?
Truces were still in place, somewhat, which was good. You know, they were fragile, but they were there, which was good. But no one really had an idea of what the truces meant, what these ceasefire agreements really meant. The individuals who were spearheading and calling themselves leaders of this whole truce movement were self-seeking individuals who were in this for their own personal gains, and didn't give a damn about the neighborhoods or the communities that they were professing to represent.
What was the role of the authorities in fostering sort of a false truce leadership?
The authorities, they systematically weeded out individuals, you know, by taking individuals like myself, whom they knew would never compromise with them, who they knew, you know, was on the other side of the fence from them, who were pushed out of the way. And then authorities, you know, again, strategically placed individuals like Tony Bogard and gave them credibility in terms of being these truce leaders and so forth. And, you know, and that's what essentially destroyed the movement. Individuals were targeted and gave opportunities, whereas the communities and the overall masses of people were left out of that opportunity, you know, I guess field or whatever, and you know, and they saw it and they felt it, you know what I'm saying? And they begin to resent, you know, laying down their weapons and forming these peace pacts or whatever, you know. And they went back, and we witnessed this backlash from that. We witnessed individuals going back to that their old familiar ways of doing things, you know, warring and robbing and stealing and killing and so forth, you know. And so now, when I'm out on the streets and you know, getting out and I'm talking to brothers about peace and, you know, about unity and about, you know, resolving their differences, and they saying, man, been there, done that. You know what I'm saying? Man, been there, done that, homeboy. We didn't get nothing. You know what I'm saying?
Dwayne Holmes speaking with Christian Parenti. Holmes is currently a staff person for State Senator Tom Hayden. One way that community activists are combating police brutality is to put pressure on citizen oversight committees that review excessive or deadly force complaints. If such committees are not in place, some activists are pushing to establish them. Anthony Van Jones is an attorney who helped expose a brutal pattern of misconduct by Mark Endaya, a San Francisco police officer who repeatedly kicked an African-American man in the head after he was subdued and pepper sprayed. The man died later that night in a police van, hogtied and gagging from the effects of the chemical spray. In March, Van Jones was one of four recipients of the Reebok Human Rights Award for his work to increase awareness about police brutality and bring enough public pressure on the city's police leaders to force Endaya out of the department.
We were able to move it forward mainly by making it very, very clear that we were fearless. The family of Aaron Williams was indomitable. They knew that their loved one had been beaten and pepper sprayed and taken from them in violation of all police policy. And we worked with them night and day, literally for 2 years, to ensure that this case wasn't swept under the rug. And when it looked like it was going to be swept under the rug, we then were willing to point fingers and name names. For instance, we accused Willie Brown, who's the mayor, liberal black mayor of San Francisco. We said that Willie Brown's police commission is trying to protect the Bay Area's Mark Furman. And once that happened, the police commissioners who had been working quite furiously to protect this police officer were forced to resign by public pressure and media criticism, and a whole new police commission was impaneled, finally. It was brave enough to fire this officer, Mark Endaya.
Attorney Anthony Van Jones. That's it for this edition of Making Contact, a look at police brutality and community organizing. Thanks for listening. And special thanks this week to Sue Supriano and Mike Thornton, who provided recorded portions and editorial assistance. I'm Philip Babbage. If you want more information about the subject of this week's program, call the National Radio Project at 800-529-5736. Call that same phone number for tapes and transcripts, or if you'd like to make a comment or suggestion for future programs. That's 800-529-5736. Making Contact is an independent production funded by individual contributors. We're committed to providing a forum for voices and opinions not often heard in the mass media. Our national producer is David Barsamian. Philip Babbage is our managing producer. Our senior advisor is Norman Solomon. Peggy Law is our executive director. Our theme music is by the Charlie Hunter Trio. For everyone at Making Contact, thanks for listening.